Hey, welcome to the DIY Garage, the podcast for hands-on, do-it-yourself automotive enthusiasts. I'm Brian Joslin, coming to you from inside the workshop studios of the Eastwood Company in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. With me today is Eastwood's own Mark Robideau. Now, we promised ourselves when we set out to do an Eastwood podcast that we weren't going to make it a boring corporate show and tell. And we stand by that promise. But we're making an exception for Mark. He's been at the center of so many Eastwood products and has long been the face of the company's R&D team in videos. And it turns out people kind of like him, so here he is. Before we get talking with Mark, I just want to remind you that you can catch the DIY Garage podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, and other popular podcast services. You can catch video episodes on Eastwood's YouTube channel, or just go to eastwood.com/garage and click on the podcast tab for links to the podcast in either format. Whatever you choose, we hope you'll subscribe so you'll never miss a new release. So with that out of the way, Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's good to have you here.
First
I
one.
Missed you the last time you were in town. We were traveling and did not get a chance to sit down with you. So before we get rolling here, there's two things that always come up whenever your name comes up when we're talking to people. First one is, man, he seems like he's got such a great shop, such a clean shop. And the second thing is, he seems like a really good guy to have a beer with. So let's talk about the garage organization philosophy. Over some beer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bring it out.
No way.
So there's one in there for you and one in there for me. And
I bet
you
can
figure out which is which.
That's the best. Oh, got one of these. Is this one yours?
Yeah. And we'll try not to rattle the cans too much on the table here.
Thank you.
So we're going to have a beer with Mark today. What are you drinking?
Yeah. Coors Light.
Coors Light.
I'm a simple guy.
And I'm on a Narragansett because I'm an East Coast guy.
All right.
And it feels good after lunch.
Yes.
So seriously, let's talk about garage organization because it's something that comes up all the time in your videos. Is that guy's got the cleanest workshop I've ever seen.
Yeah, and I hear that from other people that have been in it. I think it's something that, like as a kid, I was always, keep your room clean, keep your room. So I think that's where it started. Where it really... accelerated was I had my A&P license, aircraft maintenance.
Yeah.
And where I worked in there, the first FBO was Reading, Pennsylvania. The director in there was all about cleanliness. Tools go back in the same place, floors are swept. So that's what, so then I end up, my first shop that I built, I remember here was one of the, we were looking to get into epoxy floor coatings.
Right.
So at that time, trying to think who it was that was selling the biggest in the industry in our market, and I was testing out theirs and so I had a garage floor with a bunch of different product spots,
yeah,
all over it.
Your personal garage at home,
yeah. And it was time to put it into one solid color there. Once I did that, and then it just came to organization tools. I wanted everything in cabinets. I didn't want shelves, just because of any sanding dust.
Right,
a lot easier to keep stuff clean in there. That's where it went. I mean, my toolbox, that's from aircraft. I can open up my wrench drawer, screwdriver drawer right there and look if something's missing. You better run back to that aircraft before anything fires up because there's a wrench somewhere.
So I think we've seen over the years, we've seen, you know, inside your garage, but it was really when you recently moved to Florida, like in the last year, you started doing the Trans Am videos out of your shop down there, and we kind of got to see your garage come together a little bit in that as it evolved. And what have you got? A basic 20 by 20 kind of suburban garage down there?
Yep, it's a 24 by 36, so it's not
a little bigger.
It's not. There's a lot of our customers got much bigger than that.
Yeah,
but that one, yeah, that was like third or fourth iteration of doing. So that one, I knew what I wanted. I knew what worked in my other ones. I knew what I wanted to change in this one, and that one's nice. I can almost blow the whole thing out again. Epoxy on the floor. I did aluminum soffit for the length of the ceiling.
Okay.
So I got good reflectivity in there. I could take a blowgun to that, blow it off.
So aluminum soffit?
Yeah, and one of the reasons of being down in Florida, I was reading too many horror stories of drywall in garages there. You know, I got AC in it, but I don't run it all the time like in a home. Mm-hmm. So at nights and get some humidity buildup.
And it's bright in there. I mean, we've noticed. Is. Yeah. So walls are painted, floors are painted. White or gray? I mean, what's
floor
your...
Floor is gray, white. I like white for everything else. Yeah. It's just hospital clean.
Yeah. Talk about your storage situation. You talked a little bit about your aircraft tool chest. Like, what's your philosophy on tool storage and part storage and all that?
Like, when I set up my tool chest, I set them up the drawers from top down, similar how you take something apart. So I got screwdrivers up front. Like, say you're disassembling a door, you can inner door panel, go to your screwdrivers. Then below that, I got pliers, all type of cutting, squeezing, pinching down there. Then wrenches, sockets, as you get deeper in. So it's easier for me when I'm doing a project running back and forth. I know exactly what drawers where and again, what's missing, what's lost in there. You know, so I all over the internet is, oh, I'm missing my 10 millimeter. I don't think I've ever, well, one, I barely use one working on American cars. And two, I haven't lost that. I mean, a half inch and a 9/16 is American cars, and I don't know what the internet guys are doing. There's that many of them running around lost.
foreign cars eat them. Apparently, they drop down into places you can't get them.
Yeah,
I'm in that boat, by the way, with the 10 millimeter club. So I lose 10 millimeters all the time. I think one of the coolest things I saw come out of your new garage was that tilt rig that you put the Firebird body on. Did you come up with that on your own, or is that something
I can't take credit for that. I won't take credit for that. It was something that I saw online. A gentleman built it, and I would give him credit if I could. I know he had a Camaro on it, and it was out of wood, if you search for that.
It's like 4x4 post or something.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. He had a great idea and real solid concept on it. All I did was I just did it out of – I welded some 4x4 tubing together. And I did a little bit different radius. When I went up, when I tilted on its side, I wanted to be a little over center just for safety.
Right.
So I had it at 88 degree versus he was building everything at true 90.
Two degrees worked matter,
for him.
So.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever he did worked for him, and it worked out very, very well. I just made a little bit of change to it. And then that funny thing is that, so the car, then when it was on that, when I was relocating down south, that got put on the moving truck in that configuration. And as they're pulling it up onto the truck, they feel, oh, well, this is too high. This won't fit. So there I am, furniture in the front of it. I'm with the plasma cover at the back of this truck on the street.
Oh, man.
Cutting about a foot and a half off of the thing.
Yeah.
So.
Would it have fit otherwise? No.
No.
No? Okay. So it wasn't a wasted effort?
No.
What advice do you have for someone who's working in a small garage? I'm 24 by 36 is pretty generous, but I imagine you've worked in much smaller
garages.
I've worked
in much smaller than that, much smaller than that. And that's where organization, I mean, it's the one word.
Yeah.
That's it. And whether you want to, like, when I've had littler ones, I also do, like, home remodel stuff and woodworking, like many, many of our other customers. I kept all the woodworking stuff in the basement. I just separated mechanical from wood, and that really helped the clutter for me.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, organization is the biggest thing.
Yeah. Small garage, what do you do with parts? I mean, you've got that Firebird
sheds.
Down to shell.
I've always had sheds at my houses. Yeah, sheds. Now, where I am now, I've got I'm actually renting a damn storage unit.
Yeah.
To keep the stuff in there. I try not to keep parts where I'm working, except the ones that are needed for that task.
And how long do you hold on to stuff when you know it's junk?
Longer than I should, like okay. Everyone.
So you're guilty of it as well.
Yeah. But as a lot of guys know around here at Eastwood, if I don't see a need to use something 6 months, I get rid of it.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I buy it again 7 months.
We talked a little bit about the Firebird. You've built some F-body cars. Is that kind of your go-to?
Yeah.
Kind of an F-body guy?
Yeah, it is. As growing up, had Mustangs, done that, Novas, Chevelles, Corvette. Just loved the Camaros. I've had a couple of the first gen, second gen I've always liked. I don't know. I just like them. It's funny because when you get to like our age, you look back at that, you know, when I was 16, 17, 18, it's, you know, What did I want back then? You know, what I had, I don't want now.
Right.
But what I wanted back then is what I have now.
So what did you drive in high school?
78 Monte Carlo, and then I said Nova, and then that was it for in high school. And then after high school, more came.
Yeah. What was the first F body you bought then?
A 68 hardtop Camaro.
Camaro. Yeah. And you've had you had red convertible, I think.
Yeah.
Still have that one?
Or? No, I got rid of that. I sold that before the move.
And you're doing the Trans Am now, obviously.
Yeah. So this is the first time since I was 15 that I haven't been driving a muscle car.
Huh.
Yeah, I sold the Camaro way too soon. I thought I'd be a lot closer on the Firebird than where I am.
Yeah. Well, projects take time.
Yeah.
Is there an F body car you still want to build, or any other car that you haven't gotten to that you still
want? I want to do a split bumper.
Okay.
I'm sure everyone else does.
Sure.
And I'll even do a clone. I worked with a buddy of mine years ago. He had a 75, and then we put a 70 split bumper front rear on it. Turned out nice.
Yeah.
You know, you're driving, it looks like, until you look at the dash, you know.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about your aircraft background. Let's talk about that a little bit and how that informed what you do here. I mean, what did you bring from being an aircraft technician into this world?
The thought process. When you're going through A&P school,
what's A&P? Explain A&P.
Airframe and power plant. Okay. Airframe and power plant, yeah.
Okay.
The FAA terms, like the license is... you know, an A&P license. So you can get an airframe or power plant license, or you get both that I got. So instilled is redundancy and just the act of repeated thought of, did I do this? Did I do it right?
Always double checking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's something I bring into working on the cars. It's always double checking stuff. You know, I'll torque a bolt, and then a lot of the OCD that I have, I'll go back and I'll click that torque wrench four times.
Yeah.
That's what I do. It could be a lug on my daughter's car. It could be an engine bolt, whatever. So you have a lot of that in there. I think the biggest thing is just the as you're working through something, the thoughtfulness of what I'm doing. I'm not just throwing a bolt in there and tightening it. I mean, for example, I'm doing some custom stuff. I bought a Jeep and I'm just putting side steps on them.
Right.
Well, you put the bolts through the brackets there. Well, on an aircraft, the head of the bolt always goes direction of flight. If it's a horizontal.
Yeah.
Like wing bolts and stuff. That's how I install something now. It doesn't matter if it's a trailer hitch or what it is.
Yeah.
There's always that thought process that's always
the
in your head.
Logic behind it makes sense and carries into the into the automotive stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long did you work as a
That's
aircraft?
Seven. So about 7 years, so
when you were younger, and
yeah, and I like that. I worked at the Reading Airport up here at that time, back in the early 90s. Reading used to host one of the biggest air shows on the East Coast, and our FBO would get the fuel contracts. So, the one air show, I had a 10,000 gallon Jet A truck. I was in charge of fueling the Blue Angels. Well, on Thursday before the show, they would always go up. And they would do a show for the press and for special needs kids. They would bring out hundreds of these kids, and they were doing two shows, so they had to do a hot refueling between the two. And what that is, the aircraft come in, they line up, and they're just sitting there at ground idle. Then you roll up in the truck. Now, as a civilian, I couldn't touch the fuel hose, but I'd roll right up in front of them. There's an F-18 right there. I can ground the truck, but then the Navy personnel would take the hose and do the refueling.
Wow.
But that was phenomenal there. I put fuel in one of the B-17s that was there, Russian aircraft.
Really neat. Hot refuel, the plane's still running while they're doing that? Or
no, not
I
the...
I was going to say.
No, like, it's only
like
the Blue Angels
refill.
That do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So aircraft world, everything is like 10 times more severe, right? I mean, the penalties for failure are much higher.
We did... the aircraft was called a Blanca, and it was a wood fabric, low wing, very high performance, big six-cylinder Continental in these things. And I was rebuilding mags, the magnetos, basically the distributor.
Right.
So rebuilt the magneto on that and did a little fuel work, some general maintenance on it, everything like that. The aircraft was up. The owner of the FBO and our chief flight instructor We're up in the aircraft, engine failure. They end up putting it down on the Redding Golf Club or Redding Golf Course. Everything was great until coming up over a little berm, there's a golf cart to avoid that. And now you have no more lift because they're on the ground, no engine. Divert to move to miss the golf cart, go into some trees, hurt bad. The one gentleman had rods in his back. Anyhow, they both lived. FAA comes in, tears this thing apart. And I'm a 19-year-old kid, like second year there.
This was right out of high school you were doing this.
Well, I worked there the summers from college. I would come home, and I would work there. And holy shit. That's what goes through your stomach because you're responsible.
Staying with you, obviously.
You sign off. You're responsible for that stuff. It was a fuel failure on the tank side, on the other side of the carb. So it wasn't ignition.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you sleep any better at night knowing that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, two gentlemen I've known for years, got hurt pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah. How does that come into some of the stuff you designed for Eastwood? That aircraft
safety. Safety, redundancy, that somebody's going to be using this. And the other thing, as a parent with two kids, like the Electrobrake, all right, 24-inch Electrobrake, great selling product. A couple years ago, started working on a prototype, stuff like that. And I'm just thinking, well, there's a lot of stuff that I do with my son working on. I thought, what if my son's here and I'm teaching him how to bend sheet metal and something goes wrong with this thing and shocks him.
Right.
So that's what then... All right, so you start thinking, what's the redundancy that we have for the protection of shock on here? That stuff just keeps in your head.
Yeah. Kids change you a lot, actually.
Yeah.
What's one more aircraft question, we'll move on to other stuff. But what's the biggest difference between working on cars and working on airplanes as a DIYer?
Everything's just bigger.
Everything's bigger. Yeah,
when you go to walk around them. I think cars are more fun for me.
Yeah.
Because you don't have on aircraft, there's a standard on how to do something or a procedure that has to be followed.
To the letter.
You can wander a little, not a lot. With the cars, you have the creative, you can do whatever you want, unless you're doing a true, that concourse, nuts, bolt, restoration.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I like, a little more free creativity.
Yeah. All right, I promised you no more airplane questions. I was always fascinated by that, and I think it's a great background to serve, what you do professionally for us. On that note, let's talk about some of the products you've developed for Eastwood. And I think let's start with powder coating, because I think it's pretty safe to say that you, through Eastwood, created the DIY powder coat market. So
tell us
a little about how that got started, where you, conceived bringing that to market.
It's 96 when we started on it, and powder coating back then was, you had all of your washer, dryer, refrigerators, all that kind of stuff. But from the automotive side, not a lot other than Chrysler. They were the ones that were really experimenting at that time with epoxy powdered primer on the minivans.
Okay.
And then going from there, BMW was just getting in. They were playing with clear powder on wheels.
Okay.
They would actually use liquid color and then clear powder over that. So I just was intrigued about it, as were some other people at Eastwood at that time. And luckily down the street, we had a local powder coater, and all he was doing was railings, the metal ones, circular ones. He would do the railings, then there'd be final bolt assembly and go off to the customer. So I went over there and he says, if you want to sweep some of the shit off the floor, go ahead. So I did. I swept powder literally off his floor, came home that night, put it in my wife's salt shaker, bring some Q panels home.
Yeah.
I researched enough, talked with people. There's no internet in 96
Barely.
That I had access to, so it's not like you could learn anything.
Certainly not the way we have it now.
Yeah. Sprinkled that on a Q panel. I cured it. I was like, holy shit, I could bend this Q panel. Was that? So then...
Doing the home oven?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then I thought, well, this can't continue with this salt shaker. So I made I was doing at that time... Well, we termed hot flocking, which is what is termed. I didn't have any electrostatic. I just knew I could spray. So I was using airbrushes, gravity paint guns, siphon paint guns, whatever we had around here. I was just machining different nozzles on there to spray the powder. Then I found out about fluidizing it. So I took a gravity Binks gun, the old number sevens, and now that's what I played with. We could fluidize in that cup. All I did was machine a different piece that fit in the air cap that would actually spray the powder. John Sloan was a gentleman here, and we were playing with it, and he was in the Jaguars, and he had that iconic Jaguar hood ornament.
Right, yeah, Leaping Cat.
I don't know why he gave it to me, but he goes, oh, yeah, you could use that. So I took that thing, put it in the oven, heated up for about a half hour, brought it out, hot flocked it in a gloss black, put it back into cure, came out, and I showed that to some of the people around the building later that day. They're like, holy shit. And the second thing then was I started reading about electrostatic charging, found out color TVs have high volt. I wheeled the TV and VCR from our conference room out into my R&D, hooked that up to a gun crudely, and we did the first electrostatic DIY powder coating that we're aware of.
Wow.
Down in Malvern. Yeah, and then I refined it and turned into what it is.
Yeah. Talk about fluidizing. That's the particles moving around inside the container instead of just being pumped out.
Yep, and instead of the powder flowing like a liquid paint, you have to, fluidize it, turn it into a suspended particle in air, and then move it out through the nozzle past your emitter. You have to have that emitter at the end, which is where you get that corona charging. Basically, think of the end of that emitter about the size of a golf ball. You have that air ionized at about 15 to 25,000 volt. Every little particle comes out there, picks up a charge, goes to the part. Side note, I've tried correcting the internet, but they don't listen to me. It is no positive negative.
Okay.
Like electrical flow.
Got it.
Electrical flow and electrostatic are two different things. Electrostatic, think lightning. Lightning can go from a cloud to a tree. We've all seen it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Electrical flow needs a wire or some type of conductor. So the electrostatic charging is a negative charge in powder coating. That little particle of powder picks up a negative coating through that corona cloud and then goes to a grounded object. That grounded object is at a different potential. Think of it as, say, zero being grounded. Now this thing's at 15,000, still negative. It still wants to find that ground. That's how it works.
Yeah, and that's the magic of powder coating as we know it today. Yep. How did that grow from there? I mean, it started out with a single volt gun and then...
Once we started doing more and more parts, there was a couple of us in R&D and it was just, I mean, that was all I did. I mean, that consumed me. I would go home at night. I had prototypes at my home that I would play with, prototypes in the building at Eastwood. I'd go back the next morning with what I learned at night, and that happened for a couple months, 6 months maybe.
Yeah.
More and more parts were done, more and more people got excited, and then it just turned into, what the gun is now are the same ones, are 15 kV and 25 kV. They don't look much different than what the first ones looked like back in 98, mm-hmm. And people are like, it looks like a little Rector set, just shit stuck together and glued, and it does. But it's like what I tell customers is, you're not buying the applicator, you're buying that finished application. You want that carburetor-based intake manifold, whatever it is, to look perfect. What you're using doesn't have to.
Yeah.
It's the end result. You look at some of the best pinstripers in the industry. Go look at their Mac brushes. There's teeth mark on the back of them.
Right.
They're literally tape holding them to the barrels. But you look at what they do with them.
So on the powder gun, the latest development, we've got something bigger coming, right? I mean, that's what's the latest development on that?
Yeah, so a couple years ago, we launched our PCS 1000, which was our entry into the semi-pro market. And we launched it. We had a good price point, but we may have brought it out to the market a little bit too early. We had some problems with it. And one of the biggest ones was moldy coat. We had customers having problems doing three and more coats. We have a lot of customers that are still using it, that are very, very happy with it. But that's one thing that we do here. We get direct feedback. I talk with customers on all of our products daily, email, text. I give out my cell phone pretty regularly to customers. And the feedback, we listen. We always do. And we always take that into the product. So for the last year or so, what we've been working on is a new revised, a 2.0, we're calling it.
Yeah.
It's still a semi-pro, pro-level gun. It's going to be at that same 800, 799-ish, 849. We don't know yet what it's going to come out to. We did a clean white sheet design on it, changed everything that was issues with the original gun, improved on it. We got the only gun right now where you have body-mounted high-intensity LED light, which is real nice, checking the tight Faraday areas. And that's something that is going to be released. We have prototypes in our manufacturing facility right now.
Yeah.
Well, actually, pre-production units, manufacturing facility right now. Going to get them in here end of this month. And then if everything's good on that, we'll enter production. We should have guns here by October, November.
And so I think that's one of the things people don't realize is we release a lot of products, but the development doesn't end there. We do take that feedback, and there's a continuous development process
like
with that.
A big one is our QST 3060,
right,
the scroll.
Our scroll compressor.
That one, I was in my shop prior to this one, and I was blasting, and I had a 60-gallon upright sitting on the other side of where I was. Well, it was still a 24-wide garage, so I was 24 feet from this thing. And it was just resonating around off the garage door, and then I put our sound deadening.
Right.
I cut different shaped acoustic pieces on that. And I said, this just sucks. And I know a lot of our customers, you know, they'll build compressor sheds.
Right.
Put them wherever they can outside. It's like, no, I want something different. So now the internet is the nice thing. So I started researching some things. Well, there's scroll compressors in AC units.
Right. Same design.
Yep.
Yep.
So I'm outside my AC unit and it's running. I'm like, this is exactly what I want. So bought one of them. Well, here find out there's minimal CFM generated from those things. We'll work on pressure. So, but that turned or led me down this scroll. You know, screw compressors, we have the big Ingersoll Rand out
right,
here
the big one.
In the garage, yep. Or in the warehouse, and that runs the whole building. Too much money. Too big, too much money. Wanted something. So started looking at that. And we designed the first QST 3060. Had some issues with that. I talked to every customer and Cody, every customer on those first launches. We took care of every one of them issues. It was moisture that was building up in them that we didn't see in any of our testing. None of this. Redesign, redesign, redesign. I think we're on our fourth redesign right now. We're launching the unit this fall, and we finally captured the moisture issue problem, and we have these. When I did the design with the team here of the solve,
mm-hmm.
We also kept in mind, well, how can we make this a direct bolt-on in-field for everyone else behind that has a scroll? And that's
right.
What we have
it's
now.
It's retrofittable.
So that one there, we're going to start working with customers. We send them this kit, eliminates this whole problem.
Yeah.
So everyone that wants the future QST 3060, you're not going to have any issues with it.
Yeah.
Everyone that owns it that's listening, call up Brian. He'll get a hold of me, and I'll send you a kit.
Yeah. But I think that's a valid point about, you know, the continuous development is that every customer use case is a little different, and you can test all day long here in the studio under or in the R&D lab in your own conditions and even real world conditions, you know, using it here in the building and stuff. But
yeah.
Everyone's atmospheric conditions, daily use conditions, maintenance cycles and everything are different.
So you're exactly right. And listen to this one. So we sold 30 units to a company called Eyeglass World. And they have these small shops. Some are in strip malls, some are standalone. And what they do is this, you go in there, you get your eyes measured or corrected, whatever they do. And like an hour later, they cut lenses and you walk out
right.
Seeing. So they bought our units. Most of the chains down south area, well, they're in non-climate controlled area. And these things are running 24/7, which is fine.
High humidity.
Scrolls are designed to do that. Yeah, just... So the filters that we have on it would saturate, and then you'd end up with these moisture problems. That's where we really learned it on them. You know, we designed this for the guys at home who are supposed to stop working at 6, get something to eat, and then come back out.
Go work
at 8.
In the garage for 2 hours.
Yeah, you give all your equipment at least a little bit of break, and then you always have that midnight to whenever you get home from work.
Yeah,
the 24/7 thing is something that we learned. You know.
Yeah, that 100% duty cycle all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
You ever get frustrated when your designs get ripped off? I mean, you've got patents for stuff you've designed here. And I know, you know, our SCT is a popular one to rip off.
I got 11 of them right now. And we've had like our SCT. Well, Harbor Freight has knocked off the dual blaster that I did in 2009. The SCT, the powder coating gun. Oh, that's right. They did that. I think it was like 01 or 02. They did that. But we do Eastwood's R&D, and I don't know if they're listening. There's a bunch of companies who benefited from our R&D.
Yeah.
Where it takes us a year, 2 years to do something. They see it, and then they just knock it off. But what do they say? Imitation is flattery of some...
Sincerest form of flattery, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that's true, because some of it hits hard. You know, when you see your sales go down.
Hours and hours and hours into it, and then,
see somebody else come in cheaper. Yeah, you see your sales go down. Yeah, so... But that's what's going to happen. I mean, that's...
We've probably benefited likewise from other companies' development on some level, yeah.
I'm sure we did.
Not a direct ripoff.
But. Unknowingly, you start, you get an idea of something like a new tool or whatever it may be. You start running with it and prototyping it. And again, the benefit of the internet, you go out, do some research, you're like, oh shit, wait, there it is. It's something subliminal. You may have seen it somewhere else years ago.
Yeah.
Then your mind just unwinds and triggers it.
I just lost the question.
I am married. Yeah.
Sorry.
I thought you were going to go
there.
That's
good to know.
After a couple drinks, I knew you were going to head there.
Yeah. On the subject of automotive paints, I know a big gap for me as someone who, I tend to restore, I'm more of an originalist. I tend to put cars back to the way they were because I wanted to enjoy them as if they were brand new, when I was able to, as if I was old enough to afford them when they were brand new. We've gone into OEM paints now. I think for a lot of people, that's a big market. And I also look at custom colors for cars that weren't, I look to the OEM for custom color selection sometimes. I mean, when did that come out in discussions as an R&D product?
Same thing as this, saying a little earlier, it's 8-9 years ago. Same thing. We've seen the cost of paint and the cost of painting a vehicle just going up higher than suspension components, driveline, everything. When you look at the chart, it was just going up this far. We follow all this. And that's where the group of us here decide, well, we got to do something else. We have to control this on our own. And we've always been in chemical. We've always been in chemical. First one, we had our Corliss, which some customers may remember that, in early 90s, and that was the first rust encapsulator.
Yeah.
We were purchasing that from a company in England. So we've always been in the coatings, and then we really pioneered the detail colors, aluminum blast, spray gray, really got into those. We were given the customers, Seymour of Sycamore, Seymour Paints. They were the ones who invented the aerosol can years ago. And we really got into... let's package in pint quart. Maybe somebody wants to spray. Maybe they don't like that aerosol, that rattle can restoration. Right. So we really started packaging paint that way. But lately, like I said, a few years ago, was we need to control the cost. Otherwise, we're not going to have a hobby left. Not everyone wants a rat rod.
Right.
And not everyone likes patina. Some do, some don't. But you have to, we know people paint cars. So we had to cater that. So that's where we started working. We work with some of the best chemists in the country, help us formulate our paints.
Yeah.
We now have the OEM Select project, where basically any color that was produced OE, we can replicate.
So just like your neighborhood paint shop, except you can buy it online.
And the consistency and the quality is going to be there from us. So if something happens, you paint the car and something happens 2 years from now, shopping cart smacks it or whatever.
Yeah. I think having painted a car at home myself, I don't know, 12, 15 years ago, I had to go down to the local paint supply shop, the auto body supply shop, and they were used to dealing primarily with professionals, come in with paint code and know exactly what chemistry they wanted, this and that. And, they're pummeling me with, you want base clear, you're going single stage, you want urethane, you want acrylic, all these things that I didn't know. And I just wanted a red car that matched, you know, the BMW red that I was had in my garage at home. And I think for a lot of people, that's the intimidating part of the process, as much as painting the car is talking that language. And I think, you know, that's where, and on the marketing side, we're always working to make, you know, that process easier for someone to make that decision.
Yeah, you hit a good point. Yeah, it is intimidating for somebody to walk into that store, especially if there's other guys in there doing stuff and they know what they want and they got a sleeve of tape over here and shit like it, you know.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, it does make it, you know, the site, we're trying to always make that better every day, every moment we're trying to do. But what we're trying to do on there is have that experience, I don't want to say it, like the easiest it can be to get to what you want. You know what color you want in there, like you said. I want that OE color, that original. So that's where we're at with this line here, is to make it easy to shop. We have everything else that's needed, from PPE equipment to masking to everything else, spray guns, all the equipment that's needed to do the job.
Yeah.
The last key piece was the actual liquid itself.
Yeah. Yeah, I think talking the language is one of the toughest things about being a DIYer.
Yeah.
Whether it's tools or finishes or whatever, you know, it's just knowing that terminology. Like, I just want it to look like this, you know, when it's done. What do I have to do to get there? So, yeah. I guess that's where we come in on the education side too, is like taking down some of those barriers.
Yeah.
And letting people just do their project.
And talking to customers over the years, you know, like that's why I love going to Carlisle, because you're face to face with everyone, and I, you know, it's just buy the gun. We got 90-day no question asked policy. Take some of the epoxy primer. Don't even worry about your color. Just take a door decal with it, paint it. Just get that over with. You know, there's so much pent up intimidation of painting a car at home, especially if it's your first one.
Yeah,
that no one takes that step. That's just take the step. Then once they do, they're like, oh, all right. They call back. Well, here's what happened. Well, that's a lot. It's a lot easier to work through the problems as they're occurring rather than sit there on your chair and speculate what's going to go wrong and then never pull the trigger.
Yeah, I found that to be completely true. It's just taking that first step is usually the biggest hurdle, saying, committing to doing it. And I say that looking, you know, what's behind me here. Like, I dove in deep on this project, this Range Rover Project Sunny that we're doing. I've done other light restorations. I'm in way deeper than I've ever been. Mm-hmm. But, you know, In sequence, it's just one step at a time, but you have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And whether it's buying the gun or figuring out what, you know, chemistry you want or whatever for a paint job.
Yeah. It's the same with welding. And we never really, we dabbled with welders. Some of the listeners that know us from the beginning know that we really pioneered the spot welder and stitch welder.
Yeah.
That was used
on
an old...
We found a relic. Well, there's one here in the studio.
We used to sell an old 60 or 70 amp stick welder. I forget what it was. But you could use these attachments with it. And they worked okay.
Yeah.
But it was the first gun out there that would do a one-sided spot weld, duplicate that. And if it was... Because it has a carbon electrode. And those are a little bit finicky if you've used them. So if you did it right, if you had the two pieces clamped dead tight... You could produce a structural and very OE looking spot weld. But anyhow, that was our dabble into welders. And then fast forward to 2008, I said to the owner then, it's like, I think we could do a line. I think we could. You know, we start out with a MIG, a TIG, and a plasma. So we started working on it. Came out with the 135, the 175 MIG, and a plasma 40 amp. And it took off. My first year forecast.
That was a big gap in the market at the time.
Yeah, it was. Well,
welders
that's right.
Were
and
very
it was
expensive.
It was affordable. Yeah. So you had a 299 MIG 135 that we had customers still to this day. They'll put it up against the biggest, you know, the best out there, Lincoln and Miller.
Yeah.
And so we did that. My year forecast was based on these stud welds that we sold, you know, back in the late 80s, 90s. And a month and a half, or sorry, 2.5 months, we went through that forecast. And then we brought on the first, and again, that's been knocked off too. We brought on the first AC-DC TIG that was easy to use. And now that TIG 200, we still sell a version of that today. It's been, again, it's been upgraded and, made better and better. But that original one out there got a lot of people in this hobby comfortable to TIG weld.
Yeah. And I think if we're being honest, I think a lot of people know Eastwood as an affordable welder company as much as a
sure.
finish, you know, or yep. tool company.
Yeah.
It's really become part of who we are. Mm. And I'm looking at the lineup we have in yeah. the garage there, and just there's a lot of welder depth right now. We've got something for everybody.
Yeah. And something that goes with that was I wanted to do a Corvair. So I found,
right. I remember the Corvair body. Yeah.
We were at again, 16, 17, I forget what I was. There was a Corvair that used to run around. We used to come down here, and you could race on High Street.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd run back to Reading at the end of the night, and there was a Corvair that ran there. And I was like, that's sort of ugly but Camaro-esque because the way it was designed. So anyhow, fast forward to modern times here, we're out there. We'd go to a local junkyard, and we're just hunting on we just wanted doors for a prop here. And this thing's sitting in the weeds over there. So I asked the guy, and he says, $400. I said, you have a title? He says, it's $400. I said, all right, then I'll take it. So we dragged the thing. Or no, that's right, for that price, he even brought it back here on a rollback.
Wow.
Dumps it off. I don't know, the seized motor, nothing was good on it, but I thought, all right, we'll use this as a project, or we'll build this thing. Well, it came time to strip the paint. I wanted to see what was on it. Again, options for the DIY. You can disassemble everything to a body, you can send it out to be media or acid dipped.
Right.
You can blast it at home, or you can sit there with a DA, liquid paint stripper, do whatever you want to do in your driveway. I said, well, I've done the liquid strippers. I've done DA, I've done, you know, that side of it. I've blasted. I want something that's a little easier than that. So I thought, what about rotary sanding? So I worked for Makita for couple years, and some of the development of the belt sanders in there with what they were working on, stuff that really never came to market. But I thought, you know what, that's, we end up with the SCT, and the SCT has sold very, very well for us. Most importantly, it's benefited a lot of people in this hobby.
Yeah,
being able to remove paint rust coatings, but then also burnishing, polishing, so you can do a lot with that tool. And that was a fun project there, working on that, developing that with the team here.
Yeah, it's been a very popular one too.
Yeah, I mean. And it's bulletproof. You can throw that thing around all you want. And Harbor Freight knocked that one off. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
They did that not too many years ago.
Yeah. Talk about the process for other Eastwood development stuff. Like, where do you start with finding a gap in the market? Let's say?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what's really driven a lot of the Eastwood exclusive products, the products that a lot of the customers come to us for, was developed out of need. And that's why I always got to be restoring a car, same with you. Once we're restoring a car, you run into the same problems that our customers do.
Right.
And a lot of mindset people have is, okay, I ran into a problem. How do I get over or around it? That's the human thought process. I step backwards from it and say, well, what caused this problem? And you find a solution to that.
Get to the root.
That ends up being a different type of tool, a product. Some of the stuff is, let this take an existing product and just put some tweaks on it, make it a little bit better, easier, more accurate, whatever the need may be.
What's another, beyond powder coating and some of the things we're known for, what are some of the other gaps in the market that, you know, as cars evolve, more plastic, more computers, more electronics. Where's the future of restoration and DIY maintenance?
I think the future, that's a great question, because this is where we're at right now.
Right.
You know, the future, driving a vehicle in the United States is a privilege. It's not a right. At any time, SEMA is fighting hundreds of bills every year to keep us or to allow us to enjoy this hobby. At any time, we could get the wrong person in government, and all they'll say is, okay, every vehicle to drive on public roads has to meet 2025 emissions. And I know Holley, Edelbrock, Phytech, all the big boys know this too. And what can we do to quick make these things meet emissions? That's something that could really cut our hobby off. But your question was, what does a hobby really need now in the future? And I think there's two things that are hurting all of us restoring. Cost of paint and interior.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably two or three big interior companies in our space.
Creating that, the materials, the raw materials, the upholstery, fabrics, and things like that.
That are doing everything they can to try and keep their costs down, but their costs are just driving up price of oil and everything else. Paint's the big driveline, you can control that. You know, that we can do. You can build a motor yourself. You don't have to buy a crate motor. So, but upholstery and paint, there has to be a way for us to be able to apply a coating, and I'm not saying paint a liquid coating on it. Has to be a way to apply a coating to a vehicle at home. I don't think wraps are it. I tried playing with wraps back in the 90s. I called it thin film painting before it got big. I found out that the wraps, I'll think of the name, they were used on signs. Like the big McDonald's M was this wrap, and then every couple years you could replace it before they turned into acrylic and all the backlighting that it turned into. And I was able to do a door. I took a door. At that time, I had a 75 Vet. And the door, I just DA'd it, did some fill on some low spots and chips like that, and put a wrap on it. It was a red. And me and John Snow, that doesn't look too bad. Then I went to do the iconic quarter sail panel that wraps back into the window.
Right.
Well, now you have Avery. That's the company I was working with.
Right.
Now you have 3M and all the big boys out in wraps that have stuff to... So I thought that was going to be the solve. It's not.
And the wrap's only as good as what's underneath it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And the thing with the wrap is, what do you do on the jams? That's, you know, when I go to car shows and stuff, like, that looks nice. And then the door's opened up and, oh, that's green. And it's red on the outside.
Don't overcome that with paint either. Yeah. A lot of people skip the door jams on paint, jobs too. So.
Yeah, but I think there has to be a way to, like, I'd love to be able to powder coat entire vehicle. I've done a hood is the largest object I've done. I've done a Ford 9-inch rear drive shaft, and I did a Power Glide transmission with fluid still in it. To this day, that's still coated red.
Wow.
I'd like to do a vehicle which would be different type of lighting. We have the equipment. Our guns will spray a vehicle, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But then there has to be something else. There has to be another type of process. And, you know, painting now is no different than cavemen smashing berries into liquid and drawing animals on a cave wall. You know, paints are still that same type of process with a lot more chemistry behind
pigment, it. Pigment on a surface, Powder coating an entire car, it sounds like the challenge is getting that much heat in a big enough space to do that, right?
That's exactly it. Yeah, we're using lamps. We're experimenting now with UV powders.
Yeah. So a UV cure instead of a heat cure.
Well, it's still, you'd still use some IR as what's called a kicker, just to get the flow happening. But that's only for a few seconds. And then you go ahead and do the UV.
Interesting.
Yeah, the UV, the drawback right now is it's line of sight. So imagine the door's off and you're doing an A-pillar where you have a lot of stuff happening in there. That's where you have a little challenge.
Right. What's the hardest part of designing or adapting professional equipment for a DIY market, which is a lot of what we do? We take things out of industry and bring them down to cost and usability standpoint for general consumer.
Yeah.
What's the biggest challenge in that?
I think the biggest
all your time.
I think the biggest is when you're talking about like professional equipment and bringing it down is that over years started as something basic and got built upon into what it is now. And it got built upon that way because of maybe safety features need to be met, performance, functions needed to be added to get to that. We have to sort of reverse that down, and it's not just simply reverse engineering back to its components. It's what's the customer need out of that? Do they need this feature? Do they need that feature? Then you slowly pick stuff apart until you get down to the core of what's really useful. Then we build back in a little bit more, whether it's safety or ease of use.
Do you think there's any part of the manufacturing process, you know, for a car that is not scalable to a DIY operation, something that can't be done in a home garage on some level? I mean, we've got people painting in their garages at home.
And, yeah, I don't think so. I mean, with especially our customers, they'll do anything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you only have so much wallet spend. You know, everyone, you buy the car and then you put a budget onto it. We all know it's not realistic, but you have to try, and you have to try and, like I talked to customers, you gotta at least have that wire dog frame cage around you. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be solid walls. Yeah, you spend a little bit more on this or that, but you have to have something to contain your budget. And that's where now you can do anything you want, you know, because that labor cost to send something out is what you have no control over.
Are you excited at all by some of the file sharing and distributed manufacturing, like companies that will print your file for you? I mean, that's like a whole new world, I think, for DIY, is you can control your creating your file if you have something you just need to replicate or want to create something unique, and now you can send it to somebody.
I think that's a huge new world. And I think it's something in our industry, you know, the 3D printing, the send, cut, send type companies that are out there. Yeah. I mean, it opens a lot of doors to the customization, something that you may not have been able to do before.
Yeah. In your research, are you finding gaps in customers' abilities these days? I mean, I think some of us have talked about the gap in, like, technical training. Is it a steep hurdle for a lot of people to get into doing this?
Well, I think if you don't have enough younger generation learning from the older, then it's going to get pulled apart a lot quicker. You know, I brought something to the company years ago, alternative to experience. The concept was can we design tools that will form metal, but without having 40 years of metal forming experience? And that's something that I still think we can do. It's, but without something like that, if Gene Winfield stops telling young kids, you know, how to use a hammer dolly, then generation's going to continue to slip.
Yeah. You know? We've got guys like Matt Murray and
you just got to get, if as long as the young kids have an interest in the hobby, I have my son's 24, he'd give a shit about the Firebird, Camaro, any of them. I mean, he liked riding in them.
Yeah.
But, and I'd try to get him to help stuff. And if it was a 5-minute project, he was all over it. But if it was all afternoon and you really don't get a result, all you did was tore apart a front end and you got some of the stuff blasted, well, there's no reward for him.
Yeah.
You know, there was a reward for me because I knew I'm a step closer. I knew what the end result was going to be in my head. He doesn't see that. You know, so as long as the kids get involved.
So does he, your son, for instance, have an interest in the cars and not the process, or just not interested in?
No, he likes the cars. Yeah. Okay. He'll go to car shows and stuff like that. Yeah. Okay. It's just not the, and maybe he'll develop it later.
Yeah.
But right now it's just not the interest.
Is there still like a dream build you have in mind? I mean, we're similar in age, mid 50s. Yeah.
Give
or take. Yep. We'll just say.
Yeah. I had a ride in a, like I was 20, my buddy's sister, she had a 308 Ferrari. I think it was mid-80s.
Yeah.
And she took me out one night, and there was this same stoplight there up in outside Reading. And from the light to light, we got to 100 and we braked for the red light at the other end there.
Yeah.
And that engine behind me, that I was in love with that.
A little high-strung V8.
Yeah. And never had money or, you know, up until last couple of years started getting an itch. And that's a saying, how you get to a point where, you know, I want what I wanted back then that I couldn't have or couldn't afford or whatever the reasons were, you know, that I'd like to build.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any part of the restoration process you've never learned to do yourself? You mentioned upholstery. I don't know if that's something you've ever done.
I never rebuild an automatic transmission.
Okay.
Yep. And I want to try that.
That's surprising, actually, for somebody former aircraft. Not that it's directly relative, but just the intensity of mechanical.
I think with me, it wasn't for the lack of learning, because if I want something done, I'd rather spend too much time and too much money learning how to do it myself than I could have hired somebody to do. That's just, I always just want to learn it. But I think growing up, I was always playing with the Chevy muscle car. I mean, a turbo 350 was $250 running.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, so I never...
Just replace it
instead of rebuild them.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any process that intimidates you? I know a lot of people are freaked out by electrical, like doing heavy electrical work or...
No, I mean, from all the training we had on the aircraft side,
yeah,
any pneumatic, hydraulic, electrical, any of that stuff, No, like I said, it's just automatic transmission. That's what I'm going to do yet.
Yeah. Well, this has been a great talk. I hope you've enjoyed the beer.
Yeah, I had fun. I hope we have more. So it's almost done.
We got approval for one beer, but there's a trunk full in my car if you want the rest. So, cheers.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on. I'm glad you're around for the Summer Classic this weekend. And
thank you.
I can't wait to have you back in. So, thanks.
All right. Thanks, Brian.
Appreciate it. Yep.